Welcome to First in Future, where emerging ideas take flight. This weekly podcast is presented by North Carolina State University's Institute for Emerging Issues. And now to our host, the director of the Institute for Emerging Issues, Leslie Boney.
Welcome to another episode of First in Future. As some of you know, as part of the Institute for Emerging Issues response on COVID-19, we've gone virtual with a number of our efforts. We have a series of live webinars every Thursday at 9 a.m. with the tape version posted on our website, emergingissues.org. We continue our work on digital inclusion, the effort to get children studying at home, parents working from home, adults trying to get health care from home, able to do that at home. We're also taking some time to look at the stimulus packages being passed by the federal and state government with a particular eye toward what they mean to North Carolina, as well as evolving state policies developed in response to COVID-19. This is a time of rich, creative thinking by people on almost every issue we face, with a lot of people using this excuse of a pandemic to revisit the assumptions we've been operating on since way before the pandemic. There are people rethinking housing policy, how we handle food and hunger, the unemployment system, which government services are essential. And there are a lot of people rethinking healthcare, including our guest, Jordan Roberts. Jordan is a healthcare policy analyst with the John Locke Foundation and the co-author of a new paper looking at telehealth in the U.S., published this month with the Brookings Institution, about the regulatory barriers to expanding healthcare. Jordan, welcome. Thanks for being on.
Hey, thanks for having me. I'm glad to be here.
Hope you are safe and well.
Mm-hmm. Hope you are too.
I am. Thank you. So the path for telehealth in this crisis reminds me a little bit about the way IEI's work from home policy worked. There were always a bunch of tough issues related to it that needed to be worked through. A lot of people hesitant about taking it to any kind of greater scale. And then COVID-19 came, and suddenly in about 2 hours, we figured out how to do work from home. And it seems like a lot of things got figured out pretty quickly on telehealth as soon as COVID-19 came along.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, you know, what we saw before the pandemic was that there was a fair amount of telehealth use. It wasn't too common, but it was growing. But then as soon as the pandemic hit, we saw on one front, a lot of people due to the stay-at-home orders and fear of going to the doctor's office, they were turning more to use technology to access care. And then on the other hand, in an effort to protect our frontline healthcare workers, a lot of these large hospital systems were encouraging that people, you know, use virtual means to access and get consultation before they come in, as to limit the amount of spread. So, you know, a lot of people have said we advanced about 10 years of telehealth in a couple of months. So it's pretty exciting.
Just some notes from your paper, $200 million appropriated through the CARES Act. FaceTime got okayed under HIPAA. The idea of charging at similar rates, USHHS approved that. The Connected Care Pilot got $100 million to help providers. And all of it, as you said, just kind of happened pretty darn quickly. What are some of the big issues from the past that had to be worked out with telehealth, and which of them have now been worked out, and which of them are still out there?
Yeah, so, you know, we started writing this paper a little over a year ago, and, you know, throughout the time we worked on it, we were looking to identify regulatory barriers that hindered the adoption of telehealth. And, you know, once we were almost ready to publish the paper, that's when the COVID-19 pandemic started. And so, you know, we had this unique kind of natural experiment to see how, you know, states governments and federal governments were responding. The four main barriers that we identify in the paper are reimbursement, a lack of uniformity in how insurers reimburse for telehealth, licensure. Most states require that in order to treat patients in that state, you need a state health license specific to that state. Rural broadband, you know, telehealth is only so good as your connectivity to it and your ability to connect to other people, and existing health disparities, you know, with medically underserved communities and, you know, people that lacks a lot of health system literacy. And so what we saw in the early days were a lot of states waived these licensure restrictions, and the federal government within Medicare did too. So you would not need a specific state license to treat someone in that state. And that helped with the distribution of providers around around the country. And then we also saw a lot of insurers and Medicare and Medicaid agree to reimburse providers at parity, which essentially means at an equal rate to if the procedure or consultation had been conducted in person. And another thing too, within Medicare and some state laws, the restrictions on what types of devices could be used were also waived too, like you mentioned, including FaceTime, Skype, things like this. So that's what we saw very early on, was a lot of these restrictive regulatory policies were waived immediately. And, you know, this was in an effort to expand access to healthcare for patients through virtual means. And so most of these regulations will likely last just as long as the emergency declarations last. But, you know, what we're doing, what we hope to do in this paper is to, you know, highlight some of these issues and permanently remove them so we can have this increased access going forward. And that's what we try to highlight in the paper.
One of the threshold questions that you raise in the paper is you try to address the question of whether it works. I mean, that's mm-hmm. kind of a threshold question with this. Is it as effective? And you cite some of the pilot studies that are going on across the country, particularly in New Jersey and Pennsylvania. Can you just say something about what they appear to be finding about the potential effectiveness of telehealth?
Sure. Yeah. So we looked at, there's tons of new adoption going on within around the country, and there's tons of new ventures. But, you know, it depends. You know, there's the research is showing us that some services are better suited for telehealth, and that some services, such as remote patient monitoring, where a patient's vitals would be monitored with on their own person or in their own home, and that information would be transmitted to a doctor. Things like this, these are where we see a lot of the cost savings, where, you know, telehealth can sort of act like a gatekeeper in, you know, allowing providers and patients to agree on when it's necessary to come in, when certain procedures are necessary. So, you know, there's a lot of experiments going on, particularly in more rural and underserved communities, where, you know, small changes in new technology or new ways to access care can really boost the amount of care that these folks can get. And, you know, one of the main things that telehealth is attempting to do is to increase primary care and access to preventative care for patients. And that's really where we're hoping to see a lot of the cost savings, is that if we can manage some of these diseases and prevent chronic diseases before they become chronic diseases, then that's where we see a lot of the back end savings on telehealth. So while it's a relatively new technology for a lot of patients and providers, you know, this is the natural innovation and experimentation that we're going to see. And providers are going to figure out what fits best for their practices and their patients. And then patients will find more convenient ways to use telehealth to get the care they need while reducing costs to themselves. So it's a wide variety of things. Not all procedures can be done. Obviously, sometimes you need to be in person. But, you know, I always say that telehealth is just going to supplement the normal delivery of care. It's never going to replace it. And, you know, where we're going to see the cost savings is where, you know, we can supplement it to really replace some of these high cost, you know, procedures that require a lot of overhead. So that's kind of where we're at. And a lot of, you know, teaching universities are instituting this. And, you know, even within some Medicaid programs within state governments are looking at ways to save money this way. But, you know, we're really just scratching the surface here.
We're talking to a woman out in Northeastern North Carolina the other day, who's out at the Roanoke Chulon Community Health Center, about telehealth. And she said a couple of interesting things. One, this has helped you get over the initial barrier. So it's your first telehealth treatment that you have to, you know, kind of agree to. And the crisis has created kind of, you know, people have been willing to do that because they have to. And so they found it was not as strange as, you know, maybe they thought it would be. She also said there are these sort of interim procedures they've developed where you might, someone might drive into a parking lot and you would be there. You could see them, but you would be socially distanced from them. So I think what she said is that this has gotten people over the fear of the unknown. Just by having your first treatment, you kind of get a little bit of experiment, a little bit of experience like that. What's the cost argument for telehealth?
Well, I mean, I think on one side you say, like I talked about before, kind of acting as this gatekeeper and supplementing where normal healthcare or where normal healthcare is delivered in person. And where I see costs and cost savings on that side would be, you know, eliminating these unnecessary procedures, eliminating duplicative procedures, delivering care at a more low cost rate where it can be. And, you know, if enough of this is done, this can really lower our healthcare spending, and, you know, enough lowering of overall healthcare spending, you know, we'll start to see decreases in our premiums because we all pay for this extra administrative and duplicative care through our healthcare premiums. But then on the other side, you know, obviously technology and these big expensive machines that may, you know, be able to do incredible things such as monitor someone's, you know, blood pressure at a great distance. Those are expensive machines. And so, you know, there will be a lot of investment from providers and insurers to kind of jumpstart this. And, you know, that's, we talk about the reimbursement policies in the paper, because this is one of the big debates within telehealth is how much should insurers pay for the investment that providers make to increase their technology use with the hopes of hopefully, you know, decreasing spending upfront and on the back end. So that's one of the big debates that we highlight. And, you know, a lot of the providers feel that they should be reimbursed more. Insurers feel that they, you know, since they're not paying for care that was delivered in person, it should cost less. So it's a big debate there. But, you know, I think, you know, if we ramp up the use of telehealth, I think we can certainly reduce some unnecessary procedures and, you know, keep people out of the hospital, emergency room, et cetera, things like that when they don't need to be. But then on the other hand, it is a big investment for, you know, your smaller independent primary care physician that, you know, may not have the means to invest in that large piece of equipment and may not see enough of a benefit to do it right away. So these are all, you know, decisions that need to be weighed, but I think there's certainly going to be some expensive parts of it, but, you know, I think if supplemented right with the normal delivery of care, we really can see some across the board cost savings.
North Carolina is a no parity state. Can you talk about what that means and whether you think that's a good thing or a bad thing?
Sure. So like I talked about earlier, parity essentially means equal, and, you know, states that have parity laws, they can either mandate that the coverage must be equal or the payment must be equal or both. And, you know, we detailed this in the paper because this is one of the points we really wanted to drive. And like I said, you know, the providers believe that they should be paid a higher rate or the same rate as providing the care in person, and insurers want to pay less. And so, you know, I think it varies. Me personally, I think it varies for which services, you know, this applies to. But I think in general, we should stay away from the parity laws, because in thinking about how to properly implement telehealth into the normal delivery of care, that needs to be decisions freely made between a provider and the insurance companies that they contract with. And so it's my opinion that if the state comes in and just mandates that all of these services need to be paid at the exact same rate, that's sort of contradictory to the cost effectiveness and, you know, these opportunities that we can shave unnecessary costs off. So while I think there does need to be a balance of both sides need to come to the negotiating table when talking about how can an insurer reimburse a provider for adopting this technology that hopefully has benefits for the patients, which is a net gain for patients and insurers there. How do we make that right? And so, you know, it's my view that, you know, the government coming in and mandating this is not the right way. And that, you know, even if North Carolina doesn't have a parity law, but we see a robust and thriving telehealth environment here. And we believe that even without the parity laws, this is going to continue to grow. It got an unlikely boost from the COVID-19 pandemic. So, and like you said, it's becoming more comfortable and familiar with people. So as more consumer demand happens for telehealth, I think the insurers will see the need to, you know, make sure that they're contracting with negotiating with all the right providers to get the correct reimbursement down. So I see it more as just a free negotiation that needs to happen between insurers and providers to get that, to hit that sweet spot to where everyone gets a benefit. But you know, we need to think about, you know, overall cost too. So that's kind of where the parity debate is. And as you'll see in the paper, most states do have parity laws, but you know what we recommend in the paper is that states should be empowered to move away from these laws and allow free negotiations to happen, so that providers can, incorporate this technology as they see fit and get paid for it.
You have several recommendations in the paper. One of them is to move away from parity. Another that you've mentioned earlier is more use in primary care. The first recommendation you lay out is really just kind of a common sense thing that we need to be gathering as much data as possible now about this. Can you talk about the opportunity that we have right now?
Sure. So, you know, it's kind of a natural experiment we have. No one could have predicted or manipulated a disease that would move everyone online. And so what we're seeing, we have this rare opportunity to see how people are adopting telemedicine, to see where people are using telemedicine. So that's going to be important moving forward, because if we're, you know, if providers, you know, people like myself in the health policy world, we're trying to figure out what's the best way to, you know, apply a regulatory framework to where, we encourage as much adoption as possible, but we don't exclude any future technology or things like this. So, you know, collecting the data, what types of patients were using telehealth? What devices were they using it? What types of services were they trying to access over telehealth? Things like this can inform us as we move forward, and it can inform providers and insurers in kind of seeing where the consumer demand is for what types of services. You know, they can adjust their health benefit plans. We can see where, you know, maybe there's further regulations that may be hindering the adoption. If we figure out that there was some, hindrance for a certain population with a certain procedure. So, like you said, it's a common sense thing that we just need to do now to better understand, if we ever get back to some sense of normalcy, to where we struggled during this time, how we could have done better. And if our goal is to increase access and lower costs, did this accomplish that, and how can we be better in some sense of normalcy during the next pandemic or as long as this one lasts?
One of the other recommendations you just alluded to is the importance of regulatory flexibility. Basically, I think a lot of people's temptation is to regulate for everything we know in the moment and be hyper-specific about it, which then locks you into a situation that might not be particularly useful to you as technology evolves or other things change.
Yeah, absolutely. And this is, you know, I think one of the most important recommendations we have in the paper is that as the laws state right now, you know, at the federal government with Medicare, a lot of state laws, they actually restrict the use of certain technologies to access healthcare. They restrict where you can be to access that care. And so the way I see it, you know, we are just scratching the surface with telehealth. We don't know, or we know that it can connect patients to providers over great distances. We know that the technology is going to evolve way quicker than government works. So, you know, what we recommend is that, you know, set up as flexible of a regulatory framework so that you're including all of the current providers and technologies that we have available, but then you're not excluding anything that comes down the line that, you know, may not be covered under any certain regulations now. So it's just that, you know, as we have this brand new innovation, we shouldn't limit it just by definitions in a regulation, in a regulatory statute. And, you know, that's the current status quo that we have, is that a lot of the regulations on this are restrictive and limit the use of it, while we know that patients would be more apt to use it. And we've seen the result of removing those restrictions as more and more people have started to use it and get reimbursed by Medicare, Medicaid, and private insurers for all different kinds of uses. So, you know, especially in North Carolina, as we move forward, and, you know, there will probably, like you said, be an appetite to further regulate telehealth. But, you know, we recommend as much flexibility for providers. They're the ones that are making the decisions. We should trust them to say, I can use this technology, it'll benefit my patient, and I shouldn't be subject to any sorts of restrictive regulations.
The way you describe it in the paper is as a valuable supplement, but you also mentioned earlier that there's a decent chance that a lot of the flexibility that's been allowed during COVID-19 will just go away once the crisis is over. How do you take the best of what we're discovering now about telehealth and ensure that it continues in a post-COVID world, if there is?
Well, right. I mean, I think that's the biggest challenge. And, you know, a lot of the regulations that were waived, organizations like mine at the John Locke Foundation, we've been advocating for things like this for years, you know, scaling back licensure restrictions, just removing these restrictive regulations on the types of devices that they can use. So, you know, hopefully with all the research that organizations like mine have gathered, and then we have a lot of just empirical data of more use of the technology, you know, hopefully there, as it becomes more commonly used, as more people become more familiar with it, as more providers want to use it, as more insurers want to reimburse for it, that, you know, lawmakers will see, and, you know, hopefully our paper, you know, nudges them in the right direction, that, you know, these are actually restricting the use, they're limiting the amount of access that patients have. And at the end of the day, it just creates a more dysfunctional healthcare market than we already have. And so, you know, we should trust patients, we should trust providers to make the right decisions of what makes sense for them, what can benefit them, and then we can figure out how to pay for it. But, you know, when it comes down to it, the regulatory regime has restricted and limited and ultimately, you know, hurt patients and providers in the long run here because of how we've regulated it. So hopefully there'll just be enough, you know, observations that this, you know, there wasn't an insane amount of, you know, poor quality healthcare and things like this that people say need to keep the regulations in place. So, you know, we're just hoping that we can, you know, cement these in for the long term and they can continue to grant people access, you know, more fully than they have now.
You mentioned telehealth as something that's important for those who are currently underserved. Can you just say a little bit more about that?
Sure. I mean, North Carolina, we have, you know, one of the largest rural populations in the country, I think only second to Texas. And a lot of these places we would describe as medical deserts. They don't have enough providers, facilities to accommodate the community at large. And so as so many communities like this are medically underserved, telehealth, accessing healthcare over a great distance, these can help these rural communities that typically don't have enough primary care in the area. You know, we can connect them to primary care. If they're on a state border, you know, we can open up the licensure laws to allow, you know, health professionals in good standing with their state right across the border to help or to serve patients. That's what we're looking at going forward.
You mentioned earlier, and I just want to have you amplify on the point a little bit, the importance of broadband access when it comes to healthcare.
Yeah. You know, like I said, you know, telehealth is only as good as, you know, your connectivity. And, you know, even if you have, let's say, a provider in a rural area that's willing to do all telehealth consultations, triage, and everything, if you don't have any way to connect to that, then it's no good. And so this is absolutely part of the equation. And, you know, rural broadband is a big issue, I think, on the minds of a lot of people, as, you know, we see rural communities losing population, losing economic activity and things like this. So this is, you know, like I said, it's absolutely part of the equation. If we want to increase access to telehealth, we absolutely have to figure out how to incentivize more rural broadband, because it's just part of the equation. And, you know, I think both of them, figuring out how to extend those to these rural communities, will help reinvigorate these communities, increase their health, and increase their economic activity all at the same time. But it you know, one can't happen without the other.
Last question, a lot of recommendations in the report. You mentioned that your ideal would be if everyone just capitulated to the logic of the report and the arguments you've amassed. But if they didn't, and you could only have one of the things that you're recommending in the report, what's the most important thing to change if we really want telehealth to work and be what it can be?
I think the restrictive regulatory framework is just by far the biggest hindrance. I mean, in Medicare, before all of this, they would not reimburse for telehealth unless you were considered living in a rural area. So what good does that do to all of the patients on Medicare that do not live in a rural area? They were denied access to this care. And there's so many examples of this, of where, you know, regulatory language restricts the access to care, the technology that we already have in use. So, you know, for me, it would just be as flexible of a regulatory framework as possible, so we don't, so we can include everything that we have right now, all the technology we have right now, but then we don't exclude anything that happens in the future that would hinder, you know, a provider from just adopting something on the spot, instead of having to go check if the regulations allow for, you know, this certain type of technology that may or may not meet. So just allow providers and patients to, you know, make these decisions themselves, because they're ultimately the ones that know what's best.
Jordan Roberts, thanks for being on. Tell us how to find the report.
You can find the report at johnlock.org or on the Brookings website. And you can find a lot of other telehealth research that I've written at johnlock.org as well.
All right. Thank you. Jordan Roberts, thanks for being on. Jordan Roberts is a healthcare policy analyst at the John Locke Foundation. That's our show for today. First in Future is produced by James Herrick. Renee Potts locks down our guests. Kirsten Chang gets the word out about our show, and she's helped by you. If you like this effort, forward it to a friend or go to our website, emergingissues.org, to look through 190 other episodes we've had. Follow our coverage of COVID-19. I'm Leslie Boney. For all of us at the Institute for Emerging Issues at NC State University, thanks for listening. Stay safe. See you in the future.
Thank you for listening to First in Future, where emerging ideas take flight. This weekly podcast has been presented by the Institute for Emerging Issues at North Carolina State University. Please visit us online at emergingissues.org.